So I come at this from the plant breeder side. So I was trained as a plant breeder, and I worked in maize breeding and looked at diversity and tried to work on some new trait development and that sort of thing. And so I think that it's from that working level position that I'm coming to this, not as a lawyer. So I have a different perspective on it, but all of this information will hopefully bring you together to understand all the pieces and what you have to do depending on where you sit in this continuum of need for this issue. So I'm going to start off with why USAID is in any way connected to all of this. So in 2008, there were global food price spikes. The world started to reorient its attention to agriculture, and there was a recognition that we needed to have some kind of international engagement in the agricultural space again. We had really atrophied through the 90s and the early 2000s. And so the U.S. government response was Feed the Future. It was an initiative that was really targeted at reducing poverty and addressing undernutrition. And I think from the horticultural science community, the undernutrition piece is a really important entry point for your community where you work a lot on issues that matter to our broader initiative. The bottom point, the emphasis on S&T was something that this administration brought to this agenda. Historically, there had always been international agricultural research through university-based programs. It was a small component of AID's investment, but this was something that really got amplified with the advent and the Feed the Future's birth. So I think the key here is that AID started to fund, to the tune of about $130 million a year, international research collaborations. So all of a sudden, the agency was directly embroiled in and engaging with these issues and trying to understand how to best operate given the goals of addressing global food security. So we have a number of different types of collaborations. We have innovation labs, which are U.S. university-based research programs. These involve U.S. faculty who do research collaborations with developing country partners, either in the national, the equivalent of USDA ARS, or the local universities. We also have CGIAR research investments, which again often involve collaboration between U.S. university faculty, ARS scientists, and CG scientists. And finally, we do have public-private research partnerships, often with very small companies that have particular technologies that have potential great relevance in the developing world. And so we want to help bridge the funding to bring that technology to farmers and other places. So the point here is that U.S. researchers are interfacing with these international frameworks that govern access and use, even if you didn't know it. So I think clearly by the number of people who came to this session, I think you've all become quite familiar with the fact that this is happening. So I was going to go through the landscape, but I think you now understand what the landscape is. So I think I'm going to just cruise ahead and just focus on a couple of the points of information. So for the multilateral system of access and benefit sharing with the plant treaty, there is this website, and this can be a really useful resource for everyone. First of all, you can find out what crops are on Annex 1. As Mr. Mannheim noted, Annex 1 contains the list of species that are covered by the plant treaty, and if a country has acceded to the treaty, then if you want to access material of that species, it would be accompanied by an SMTA. So you know what footing you're on. So the Plant Treaty website is a really great starting point for everybody. I'll go into a little bit of how this all works. So basically, you have to have a standard material transfer agreement accompany the material, and there can't be modifications made to the SMTA. It's not a negotiable document. It's fixed. However, there are some side agreements that are authorized. So you can get the SMTA, and then a country, if they're giving you the material, could also append additional provisions. And so you just need to be aware that that can be the case. But the actual text of the SMTA can't change. And the SMTA follows the material, so you're theoretically allowed to do third-party transfer. Once you receive the material with the SMTA, you're free to move it on to the next potential interested researcher as long as it's accompanied by the SMTA. So that's sort of the basic provisions, because there are some instances where third-party transfer is not allowed with other types of agreements. The other thing for the tech transfer office people, if there's anyone in the room, the SMTA is essentially a licensing agreement and an MTA combined. So even though it's called a standard material transfer agreement, in the U.S., we think of an MTA as one thing, and it's just the terms of access, but the licensing arrangement is often another agreement, and I'll defer to the lawyers to explain those distinctions. But within the U.S., we think about those two as separate functions, and the SMTA is a combined, it's a combo agreement. So you are signing up to the terms of the licensing agreement from the get-go. In addition to the monetary benefit sharing that I think we've talked about at length, the non-monetary benefit sharing is a really important part of the plant world. I'm sure many of you who have characterized material have really unique accessions, often find that your collaborating researchers are less interested in money and they're more interested in knowing what you found out about it. When you genotyped the material, what did you find? When you started to put it in, you know, in multi-location trials and start to do screening, what kind of pressure did you apply and what happened? What did you find resistances that were really interesting or novel? And I'm sure in the horticultural community in particular, quality traits are of great interest. So I'm sure you know that your collaborators, those non-monetary benefits are a really important part of the plant breeding world, for sure. And you all know that. So I think we've gotten through all of this. So this is the piece here. So if you commercialize material, there are basically three possible payment options, and you can choose which one you're going to do. This, in October, is the governing body meeting of the International Plant Treaty. So between now and October, there's an enormous amount of work on how the SMTA could be modified for this piece. What are the terms that are listed here that are working or not working, effective or ineffective? And so there, we are open for comment at this point. And certainly, as I noted before, you're welcome to, if, for those of you who dig into the minutia on this, or your tech transfer offices, or the legal teams in your communities, really looking into this and thinking from the perspective of your discipline and the perspective of how you all operate, what provisions make more sense? And so at the governing body meeting this October, the SMTA's terms, this section, is going to be looked at. So we really welcome any kind of comments. So again, I think Nagoya has been covered adequately. Just a couple of, I think the clearinghouse has already given to you, but you'll have access to these slides. I think we just come to the best practices. So don't just assume people you collaborate with know the rules. Scientists have a lot of to do, as you all know, to learn all the legal obligations you have and dig into the depths of the genome of your organism. It's a lot to do. And so I really think that accessing the resources of people like intellectual property lawyers, like the people you've seen in the room, your tech transfer offices, really rely on them to help you navigate this, because as it's been already mentioned, this landscape has changed enormously in the last 10 years, and you don't want to make a misstep. It can really have reputational harm or economic implications for your institution. I think the clarification of expectations on the non-monetary benefit sharing is really important. Increasingly, as we enter these collaborations with huge collaborative research networks, having transparency, open data platforms, there are a lot of things that people are starting to move towards that that can just be baked in and recognized as non-monetary benefits. So if all the data are going to be uploaded to the cloud and everyone has access, that's something that can be characterized in the agreements among the researchers to make that clear. Developing an IP management plan, this is something that we've increasingly encouraged in our research collaborations between U.S.-based scientists and their international partners, because there's often the material you bring into the collaboration, and then there's the material that's generated by the collaboration. And so we want to make sure that those things are really clear so that the expectations of the benefits on the other end are also clear. And I think people who have worked in industry are really familiar with this. Academic researchers who are entering into this landscape, we have templates on our website. If you go to USAID's website, you can find these templates to give you some ideas. And another thing that's come up, actually, that I found very useful is many of you may have had long-standing collaborations with individuals and institutions in other countries. You may have gone to graduate school with them 30 years ago. You've been collaborators your whole life. The two of you trust each other absolutely. And unfortunately, those trust relationships can be really compromised when people are interfacing with these national legal obligations. And it's painful. I mean, I'm sure I see some of the nodding in the room indicates that this is not foreign to you. And so some of the practices we've seen have worked is kick it up a level. Have an institutional MOU from your center to their research center. Let the bureaucrats at the top sort this out. Let the legal offices sort out, and then it won't harm your relationship with this person. Because it is really important in the scientific community for trust networks is an incredibly important thing that makes science move forward. And we know that. So this is just a pragmatic option that I've seen work in the collaborations that we fund. So there were two points that I wanted to bring that were raised in the question. So I think you had a question about the collections in a country. So the national program leader in Washington, Peter Breding, I'm sure you know Peter, he can definitely give you resources to help navigate the landscape for the species that you're collecting in the country where you're going. We routinely, as an interagency group, review challenges that collectors, exactly funded by Karen Williams' office, have faced, and we see the issues that are coming through, and we try to find resolution just from the various information that we have. So definitely encourage you to engage with the national program leaders to sort those out. The other thing is that, again, those institutional MOUs, kicking it up a level also helps get greater clarity and transparency of what's going to happen when you do get this grant and you're going to move or you're going to go and do collecting. Higher level institutional MOUs help also protect you in country to ensure that you've done what you need to do to follow the laws at the local level. The other one was, this is just thinking about junior faculty versus more senior faculty. For those of you who are on the verge of retirement or shifting out of your species, you're moving on to new crop, moving on to new issues, you may have enormous numbers of accessions that are just sitting in your lab. You've got your seed, you know, your seed bank, and you may or may not be planning to use it. When you are going to give that to the new junior faculty who's so excited about that new species, records are critical for that junior faculty. You in your head know all of that material. You remember which collection trip that was from and what year it was in, and whether it was before 92 or after 92 makes a lot. It's really important. So records, at the very least, that piece of information. If you as a senior faculty or senior researcher can just put two pools of material together for the people who are going to inherit your collections, the stuff pre-92, and have it clearly documented that that's the case, that makes a big difference for younger scientists who are coming in and using these materials. The other thing is that for the junior faculty, if you are inheriting something, you need those logs. You need them more than the senior faculty that's vacating the material. So I think that depending on where you are in your career and how well you know the materials in these collections that you're going to be using, these are questions you need to ask that people might not think of. So going back to some of the points I made earlier, how to shape the process. There are formal processes into which we as a government have the ability to provide input, and we really look to the society. So ASTA, the American Seed Trade Association, has been very active for years on this. But the perspective that they offer is a specific perspective around the seed industry. But there's a whole array of stakeholders and perspectives that need to be represented in these fora. And unless there is aggregation of information from the societies, we don't know. And it's hard to do surveys of all the communities to figure out, because half the time it's just like, what are you people talking about? And how does this affect me? So even just getting to that level of understanding, you would have spent 20 minutes reading before you even started the survey, and you'd have just, turned it off and moved on with your day. So it's really hard. It's really complicated landscape. We need to have your input, or the rules and the parameters of these discussions aren't going to get better or more streamlined. So to achieve the goals that they have, but also to be relevantly, oriented towards the way the communities work. Different sectors operate very differently. So to that end, there is an SMTA discussion that will be on the agenda. It has many organizations have put a lot of time and attention, have a lot of lawyers scrutinizing every word to really find what would be the way to structure the terms to make the SMTA more functional. That is going to be discussed in October this year. So if your community looks at the SMTA, and from the perspective where you sit, no matter where you sit, you work for an organization that commercializes products regularly, and you have a ton of proprietary material, or you're a completely open access operation in a university, that entire spectrum needs to be clearly articulating the issues that face you for the development of this SMTA, or it's just going to be a dysfunctional mechanism. So we really, really, really encourage you to speak to us through your societies. We need to have, sort of aggregated up. So with that, I will just give you some further reading. The two websites are a great place to start to get familiarized with this. And I think our panel can take questions, right?
Yeah, perfect.